Hello everybody and welcome back to the Finding Your Feet podcast. This is a podcast that is dedicated to helping you live your best life.
We have a really exciting guest on the show with us today. We are joined by Dr. Jolene Brighton. Huge fans of this woman.
We are.
We've been wanting her on for so long. She is the fountain of all knowledge when it comes to everything to do with hormones, sex, your genitals, your overall body, health, everything, birth control, everything, periods, the pill. Oh, we talk about it all.
Yeah, she knows it all, and she's also just like really funny, isn't she?
Oh my god, she's so funny.
So like down to earth, like she's just amazing.
Yeah, you're gonna learn so much in this episode. And also, if you are a girl and you are in a relationship or you're with a guy or do whatever, send this to him, because I feel like for men as well, this is, or even if you've got like guy friends that, you know, you just want to look out for them, send this to them, because she goes into detail about women and female orgasms and there is a lot in there for men to learn about how to turn women on, how we work, how brains are different to men. Like, women are getting turned on throughout the day. It's not just there in the moment when they see you naked.
Yeah.
They will be getting turned on and turned off throughout the day by all these different things, and it's literally fascinating. And when you know about yourself, you're like, it's just great. So send this as well to the men in your life, because you'll thank us later.
Yeah. Not just for the girlies. So therapy has helped me so much over the years in my evolution, in my self-development and in my healing. And I feel like you go through waves of going in and out depending if you feel like you need it. And I'm currently going back into a wave of getting support and therapy. And there's no other place that I would go to other than BetterHelp for talk therapy, because I think they are honestly absolutely amazing. And I'm so, so proud that they have sponsored this podcast for quite a few years now, isn't it? So if you don't know what BetterHelp is, it is a professional online counseling service, and it's done from the comfort of your own home. So it's all done online. You can set up weekly voice calls, video calls, or even send text messages to your therapist. No awkward waiting rooms, no need to leave the house. You can all do it from the comfort of your own home. They have thousands and thousands of licensed therapists. So whatever you feel like you need support for, nothing is too big, nothing is too small. If you feel like you just need someone to talk to, if you feel like you have some kind of trauma that you want to work through, they will match you with the perfect therapist. And then even if you're matched with someone and you think, want to slightly work on something different, or I want someone that specializes in something else, you can actually change for free until you're happy. BetterHelp's mission is to make therapy more accessible and more affordable for people all around the world. And they are also offering our listeners a 10% discount off your first month of therapy. So if you do want to start your own therapy journey with BetterHelp, then you can head to betterhelp.com/findingyourfeet. That is betterhelp.com/findingyourfeet and start your own therapy journey today.
So we'd just like to welcome Dr. Jolene Brighton to the podcast. We're so excited to talk to you. We are big fans of you. We read both your books. We have like had our lives changed by Beyond the Pill, come off hormonal birth control because of it, and learned so much about our hormones from the amazing like content and information you put out into the world. And I feel like you're like quite one on your own in that, like you're really at the forefront of educating women on their hormones and their bodies and all of this. So I'd love to know, just briefly before we dive into all of the sciencey questions and the hormone chat, just love to know a little bit more about you and like why you do what you do and how you got to where you are now, where you're so dedicated to helping educate women about their bodies and their hormones and everything, so they can really understand themselves and like live happy, healthy lives.
You know, I get asked this question all the time, but in this moment right now, I'm like, it really comes down to I just can't shut my mouth. I just can't shut my mouth. In that, I cannot sit by and watch all of the gatekeeping, the misinformation, and so many women struggling, all because their doctor doesn't have time in the visit, or their doctor never studied nutrition, or their healthcare provider just doesn't take their symptoms seriously. And as I talk about in Is This Normal, you know, there was one study I brought up where a woman going to the emergency room with abdominal pain, she is 30% more likely to stay in that waiting room and not be taken back immediately compared to a male counterpart. Yet she could be having issues of a reproductive capacity like an ectopic pregnancy. And what these studies and many of the ones I go through in the book really illustrate is just how little the healthcare system takes women's concerns seriously, whether it is something extreme like pain and could be life-threatening condition, or what's going on with their hormones. And we all get this narrative, I certainly got it as well, that our hormones are meant to make us villains. They're just there to betray us. And in reality, they're made to give us superpowers. So I can't shut up about it. And that's why I do what I do.
Yeah, amazing. Well, you do such an incredible job. And that's what I love as well, is like you talk about these really important subjects, but you always like make people laugh. Like I'm always laughing at your clips. So thank you for bringing it in such a lighthearted way. But we're going to dive straight in. So we want to start with, what exactly is a libido, and how for men and women, both maybe struggling with their sexual desires or libido, what are, maybe we can begin with like, what are the signs that they may be struggling, and then what are the approaches that each one of those could take to like change it?
Yeah. Okay. So this is a great question where you started with like, what is libido, right? Because everybody talks about this, but then nobody really knows what it is. And so a better phrase for this is maybe sexual desire, because I think that's a lot more tangible. The desire for sex, the desire for, you know, anything that is intimate. So I say anything that's intimate because sometimes people are like, sex, penis, vagina, that's what sex is. And as I talk about in the book, really sex is whatever you define sex as. So I often, when people are talking about a low libido, they're talking about they're less inclined to initiate sex, or maybe they don't think about sex, or they're not interested in sex, or they're just finding that, you know, even when their partner is putting the moves on them, they're like, meh, I don't know. So as I illustrate in the libido chapter of Is This Normal, your metric is the one we measure. So what has your libido looked like over your lifetime? And if it's been, and over your lifetime, like since puberty, but if it's been like pretty constant or constant in a relationship, we're not as concerned about that. If you know, your comparison is like, oh, well, it's not the same as my partner. Okay, well, you probably don't sleep the same, poop the same, breathe the same. Like it's not the same. Like you're a different person. So that's normal. But in terms of like when we're struggling, so we can struggle. So you talked about beyond the pill. So birth control is well recognized to be one of the medications that can cause our libido to crash. Same with like SSRIs, and all of these have a time and a place, but we don't often get talked to about how these medications can be the reason why we don't have any sexual desire. Now, in terms of male versus female, what's very interesting was when you look at the research is that it's the same. It's the same regardless of your gender. The experience of lacking sexual desire, the experience of maybe arousals getting hijacked. So that can be another thing people see as low libido, is that, well, I'm getting into it and then I'm just like not into it anymore. And so that loss of arousal. And so a couple things that can be going on in both situations. So if we're talking, you know, really, I mean, any body, low testosterone, low estrogen, elevated inflammation. These are some of the factors people don't often think about when it comes to low libido, but your thyroid health and your adrenal health can also be playing a role. And so that's just the hormonal piece. Of course, there's so much more. And I talk about the psychology and the situation and the context of things. But you know, and this is becoming a long answer because there were three questions here. So to get to the third part of this, what can be done about it? So we really want to look at the layers of what's affecting you and what is causing you to feel like you have low libido. Maybe your sexual desire is fine and it's normal. And I have a quiz in the book and I have things to help you understand that. It just might be your normal and you're given the perspective that it should be spontaneous and like you see in the movies. However, if it is due to issues like low vitamin D, we want to get more sunlight exposure. So for any gender, low vitamin D can be linked to hormone issues and to low libido. And so more sunlight exposure, especially in the morning, because you're less likely to burn, but you're also going to help with your cortisol rhythm and work on that cortisol piece as well. You may need to supplement with vitamin D. When we talk about testosterone, So people jump to testosterone right away and they're like, it must be the testosterone. That's what I want to fix. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. But if you have low testosterone, you will not just have a low libido. You'll have a low mood. You will have low energy. You will also find that you have low muscle mass. You're starting to lose muscle mass. So there are other symptoms that we see with low testosterone. So I said a whole lot. I can say a whole lot more because, as you know, I've written several books and it's one of them's giant, but that's just some of the things that are, you know, pretty easy to start evaluating, like, where's my vitamin D at and where is my testosterone? So I have a whole quiz in the book to help you understand if you have low testosterone. And then I give you solutions, like doing simple things like eating more zinc in your diet, increasing your muscle mass. These things can help if it is in fact a testosterone issue.
It's so interesting about the vitamin D. Like, so is, you know, like when you go on holiday and you're obviously on holiday, so you're more relaxed. I feel like your sex drive might even just go up just because of that. But like, obviously, well, where we live here in the UK, we don't get a lot of sun apart from like for a few months in the year. But especially in the winter, it's really dark and it goes dark at like half three in the afternoon. So like I really notice, I can just notice things like that when I go on holiday, like that I notice my sex drive will go up just from being in the sun. So is that how quickly that vitamin D actually impacts your libido? Like, so you're the doctor, you're the expert.
Okay, so this is the cortisol component, and I love that you bring this up because stress is, it's a cock block. Okay, it just is. It is what it is. And so when it comes to stress, what we have to understand is that when you have ovaries, you are very, very in tune and sensitive to the environment, and you are constantly surveying the environment, not consciously, but you are surveying the environment. And if any of the signals are, it's not safe, that is going to mount a cortisol response from the adrenal gland, so a stress response for survival, and at the expense of reproductive health and reproductive hormones. And why is it at the expense? Because it's expensive. It's very expensive to be fertile. It's very expensive to have a baby. Like when we're talking about like we don't have enough energy or we feel like we're under threat, your body is, it has not evolved to where we are today in terms of technology, right? Like we just came out with AI and like, oh my God, like your body is like, it's so slow moving compared to technology when you think about this. And so we have a body that is well designed for survival, but it is evolutionarily mismatched to the environment that we currently find ourselves in. And so what that means is that if your job is stressful and your boss is yelling at you, your body doesn't know if that is a threat from a predator or if that's just like a jerk, you know, and like that's going to pass kind of situation. Your body sees that as a threat and mounts a response. And so with that, we will find that when we're under stress, we have diminished desire. I go through in the book, I put a whole diagram. I don't know about you guys, but I'm really visual and I feel like we live in a very visual age now that I'm like, let's put as many diagrams and graphs to help people like understand what's going on without having to read like paragraph upon paragraph about their body. So I have one showing what happens with stress in the body. And so stress is definitely going to be hampering some people's desire. Understand if you're listening to this right now and you're like, but when I'm stressed, I'm like really in the mood, like I'm super horny. You're an outlier, but also stress may be a release for you. And that's normal because people are always like, oh my God, am I a freak? Not, well, maybe you are a freak in the sheets, but you're definitely normal.
Yeah, so interesting. So like, I feel like society really kind of pushes this narrative as well that like women have a lower sex drive than men and that men are always up for it and want to do it and women just aren't. Is there any truth in that?
There is some truth in terms of like, so anytime you're collecting data and you come up with this bell curve, so for people who can't see me, just to think about a bell, and right in the center where it's peaking is where the majority of people are lying. And then you have all of these outliers on a normal distribution. There are outliers of these things. And so I say that because there, you know, when you look at it, a lot of men do fantasize and think about sex a lot more often they're very simplistic in their fantasies. So I think it's not hard for their brain to like go there and come back. But it's not fair to say that all men are like this because they're not. And men who are not are like, is something wrong with me? No, there's not something wrong with you necessarily. I would evaluate a lot of other things before making that call. And when it comes to women, you know, there was a time I remember when Megan Fox had said, oh, I have a libido like a 14-year-old boy. Like I want sex all the time. And the headlines were like, oh my God, Megan Fox is like a man and like always wants sex. And I just laughed because I'm like, no, that's totally normal for women as well. And I would also ask, like, were you ovulating at the time they did the interview? Because if you were, odds are your libido was really up. And I think that's like, that was a perfect example of where society really likes to put everybody in buckets and be like, well, if you were assigned this at birth, if you have these genitals, like then therefore you have to perform in this way. And it's not totally true for every person. And so there is some truth to the fact that some people have higher desire than others based on their gender and their hormones and all of that. But I think what's really important to understand is that a lot of women have what is termed responsive desire. And so this came from a researcher, Dr. Rosemary Basson, and I talk about her in the book. And there's that spontaneous desire, which is what we associate more with men. Sex is always on the brain, always ready to go. And then there's responsive desire. And responsive desire is also normal. Men can also have responsive desire. And it is a situation where you're less inclined to initiate sex, but you are into it once things get going. Once the train is moving, you're like, I am here for this ride. And that is also normal.
Yeah, that's also interesting. There's another thing that I've heard you speak about. I've read about in the book, Come As You Are, but I've also heard you talk about it on podcasting. I heard you talking about it on the Model Health Show. And it was about that concept of the accelerator and the brakes. Because it was hearing you talk about it that introduced me to it. And then I went and looked at it some more. But knowing that really, really helped me understand how women get turned on and how their sex drive works. And I think it like no one knows about it that much. And like, actually, it's very life changing. So I'd love for you to like speak on that as well for our audience to understand.
Yeah. Well, as you mentioned, Come As You Are, the entire book is about this model. And so some people have said, like, how is this normal different? And I'm like, oh, honey, buckle up, because we're going into hormones. We're also going to talk about discharge and STIs and your periods and like how your menstrual cycle affects your libido and your desire and a lot more intricacies. And so if you've read Come As You Are, I feel like you've already got a foundation of really good knowledge. And now I'm going to level you up with, is this normal? So the research is Bancroft and Jansen's research, and they came up with a model of the sexual excitation and inhibition, which is the gas pedal and brakes. This is their analogy. And it's, I would just like, I'm like, man, Emily Nagoski, so many people are like, that is her research and that's her model. And I'm like, she totally cites them in the book. But I'm like, man, the way people like read that and just like fell in love with her as an author, I just think is so, so incredible. So it's actually these two gentlemen who started this research to understand men. And so what I'm going to talk about here applies to men or women. Really, again, this is another one of those things that like it can apply to any gender. So with the sexual excitation and inhibition, people will think about some of these things as like a turn on or turn off. Now, why the light switch analogy doesn't work so well is because we don't just flip it. Gas pedals and brakes work so much better because what do you do? Well, you better not just be like in the car. That would be nerve wracking for anyone with you or near you on the road, but it's an ease, right? You ease in the gas, you ease the brake. And that I think is such a better way to think about this. Now with the gas pedal, this is where everybody likes to focus when it's sexy time. If they're like, And a lot of this is because this is marketing, right? It comes to Valentine's Day and they're like, get the roses, get the candles, get the chocolates, get the, you know, massage, get the things that are going to like turn her on. And it is important to know the things that turn you on. It's also important to understand that those things that I just mentioned aren't really turn-ons for a lot of people, even though marketers are like, this is the way. Actually, in fact, those are gestures of you caring about your partner. So that can show up in a lot of different ways. So everybody wants to focus there. But what happens when you drive a car? when the brake is on. Maybe you've done this as a teenager. It doesn't go. If it does go, it doesn't go smoothly. It's kind of choppy, and sex is the same, which not, I'm not, what I'm illustrating right now doesn't sound appealing. I'm sure you can let us know in the comments. Now, the way I like to think about this, like going a little bit further, is, you know, your sexual signals, the stimuli that come in, being like a train, and your nervous system being like a train track. So your nervous system is what's really important with sex. Okay. Before we jump to the clitoris, know that the clitoris has nerves, and that is why this is so important. And your brain, as I talk about in the book, like some people can think off, your brain is really the, what we're cueing into when it comes to, you know, sex and sexual excitation stimuli. Now your partner may be trying to send that train with the sexual excitation stimuli. And yet throughout the day, you may have encountered the breaks. And those breaks can look like things like, so for example, maybe you come home, you've had a really hard day. It's been stressful. We've already established stress, break. And maybe you were out shopping that day and you were trying on clothes, and why do some places do this, but they do it. The lighting's not right in there. And so you're like, I can see every freaking dimple. You know what I'm talking about. There have been times where I'm like trying on clothes. I swear, H&M, if you're listening, you're one of the worst. And I literally am just like, I don't like what's happening here. Like, I've had two kids and I don't like what I'm seeing in the mirror. I'm sharing this because this is a normal experience, yet we're all supposed to be body positive these days and just like never feel this way. Yeah. Okay. Anyhow, this is a big break for a lot of people, is body image. And that can be a break for the sexual stimuli, but it also can be a break for getting you out of arousal. So maybe you had that experience in the dressing room, that break's been laid down. And these things have nothing to do with your partner, right? These are your things. And yet you come home to your partner and you're like, hey, I really want to talk. Like, I've had a totally shit day. Like, can we have a conversation? And they're like, not now, the game's on. They just laid down a break. Because you, especially as a woman, need to have your emotions tended to feel safe and to feel cared for, to be able to even release those breaks, but also to feel like you can allow somebody so intimately into your space that is coming into your own body. So this is really important, I think, for male counterparts to understand that puts down a break. And so now you've got all these breaks, right? And they're like, oh, I see all these dishes and I've got to do these dishes and I've got these things on my mind. And your partner comes on and the game is over and they're just like, I'm going to brush up on you. Like, ooh, you're looking so good. And you're like, I'm just not even picking up these vibes. And that is not just because, oh, that one thing that they did. It's because of the series of breaks that have been laid down. And that train literally cannot go down the tracks. It just hits those brakes one after another. And so this is important for partners to understand, because sex for women and foreplay for women is an event that begins outside of the bedroom. And nobody's owed sex. So sometimes when I'm talking about this, men are like, well, this doesn't take into account what I do all day. And like, I've had a hard day and I just want to have sex, so she should have sex with me. And I'm like, ick. Oh my God, they're so gross. Okay, but like somebody didn't teach you. So let's, instead of me, like as a human, I'm like, ick. As a doctor, I'm like, okay, let's teach you something here, because obviously you're not understanding things then. These are not conscious decisions for her to be out of the mood. She can't just consciously be like, oh, let's just remove all these breaks, like on her own throughout the day, like if she's never been made aware of them. And so that's why I put a quiz in the book that's a very common – it's a truncated form of a very common intake form used in sexual psychology that was actually developed from this model of Bancroft and Jansen. And I encourage people to take that themselves and to have their partner take it as well, because it opens up such a great conversation to understand the things that – turn you off, the things that turn you on, to put it in the terms that most people are using, but really what are your gas pedals and what are your brakes? That way they know where to focus on that energy, where to focus their energy. And it's very little in the, you know, gas section, as I was talking about before, and it's a lot more on the brake department. And so the way that your partner is showing up for you, tending to you, the context of that situation matters, because women don't just have sex, as we understand from the research. Women don't have sex just for orgasms. They're really nice. We do love orgasms, but we also have stress because we want to connect to our partner. We want to make sure that we are tending to the relationship in a way of building intimacy. And that's not saying that we're just being self-sacrificing for our partner. We know that this builds intimacy. This helps us have connection. And when you ask people, well, I'll ask you, when you ask people in the research what makes for the best sex of their life, what do you think people say?
I think connection.
Hmm.
For me, yes. Anyway, connection and feeling safe.
Yeah, it's intimacy, it's connection, it's empathy. It is all of those things, and it is not orgasms. Now, I'm an advocate for orgasms all day, every day. I think everybody should be having them weekly, and I illustrate all the benefits in the book as to why. But if you're not, that's okay. And if you're feeling satisfied after sex, this is where society is like, orgasms make for good sex. But people, when you take away anyone judging them or seeing them or knowing who they are like, actually, that's not it. That I can get off by myself. Like, what I want out of sex is so much more. And so for men to understand, it's especially for women. It can also be true for men, but it's especially for women. It's everything outside of the bedroom that leads to that sexual satisfaction.
Wow, that's so fascinating. I really love that analogy of hitting the brakes. I think that's so, can often happen where like that happens in relationships and then they think it's all about them, but actually it's everything leading up to that moment.
Yeah.
I really hope a lot of guys end up listening to this, because I think like that information is like literally life-changing.
Oh, I was going to say, you know how men will listen to this? If the women who are listening to this share it with them. So men, we know, they don't go to the doctor. Men go to the doctor when the women in their lives force them to go to the doctor. Men don't usually make changes on their own until the women in their life. It's so interesting. You know, I saw Dr. Amen talk about the research of how women who are married to men die younger. And part of that is because of the stress of taking care of men. So I say that as somebody who's married to a man and cohabitates with a man. And, you know, I have a husband and I have two male children. Who I'm really, really trying to like instill all of these concepts, because I'm like, man, you will go so far if you just understand all of these like little things, like just pick up the towel off the bathroom floor. Like, and I will say that my husband has really come so far. In the beginning, he wasn't like, you know, horrible or anything. I just want people to understand that he didn't arrive at this place of understanding, you know, how to basically help out in that way and like how all of this works on his own. It took lots of conversations. And I think that's important as well, that sometimes as women, we're just like, but I understand this. So why don't you understand this? Men are not often taught that they need to anticipate the needs of their partner. And they're often taught that they are the center of the universe by society in some way, like, right? Like, and there is a lot of teaching and language around like women being there for men. Like, we are here to support them, to help them, right? Like, and even to be, you know, a sexual vessel for them, all of these things. And so I just bring this all up because it can take years sometimes of working on a partnership to arrive at a place where you are feeling like you're in a good groove and you have this level of satisfaction. And I don't think that I share enough that this is something that takes energy and effort on both parties in a relationship. And it is not something that you arrived at tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. So do you think the best way to start that sort of seed of knowledge growing and stuff between you and your partner would be to share information like this, like send podcasts, or like, so you can get to that point where you can have these conversations where they want to learn and understand, and then they're taking all this in and like acting on it?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, sharing podcasts, sharing resource, just putting it on the car and having you both listen to it and then being able to talk about it afterwards. Because when the information is new to you, Now, I will say I'm a big fan of like learn it, teach it, because then it becomes your own. But if the information is new to you, it can be hard for you to explain and articulate all of this. But I have had a lot of women who have told me their partner is reading Is This Normal with them. It was so interesting. Like a friend of mine actually sent me a text and she was like, here's my copy and here's my husband's. Like we each got our own copy and we're going to like do our little book club around this just for their partner to understand not just the sexual health part, not just the libido and how to have better sex, but their hormones and how they cycle and how to support them throughout the menstrual cycle and how to understand. So here's a big phenomenon that happens. You're ovulating, your estrogen's up, your testosterone's up, you're fantasizing about sex, you're thinking more about sex, you want sex, your clitoris is like, I will swell on command, let's do this. And then you ovulate. And within a couple of days of ovulation, your libido just feels like it fell off a cliff. And you're like, I'm not interested in sex whatsoever now. And the male counterpart in the relationship, and I can't even tell you how many times this has happened in my clinic or just I'm talking at parties with people or on social media, the male counterpart's like, she was super, super into me and now she's not. And I feel like something's wrong with me or wrong with our relationship. And it's like, no. She just ovulated. Now progesterone came onto the scene. And when progesterone comes onto the scene, it's not that it's trying to betray you or in any way. It just says, listen, you had your chance for egg and sperm to meet. And that's what these hormones are all about. And that may or may not have happened. I don't really care. I'm just going to keep progesterone up. Actually, progesterone does care very much, but progesterone is going to be up. And then you're going to feel like you want to cuddle more. And like you feel, and if it's right, then you're going to feel like more connected to your partner. And if it's wrong, as in you don't have enough progesterone, you're going to feel like you might want to cut your partner because they chew too loud or they're breathing with their mouth open. And that is called PMS, friends.
It's all like such good, valuable information to share, definitely, especially on the menstrual cycle. But now we spoke about like sexual desire and the steps and stages which need to take place with each person. I love to talk about the clitoris and why the clitoris is such a mystery, because I thought this part of your book was so fascinating to learn about the history of the clitoris and why it was kind of exiled.
Yeah, well, because this is okay. Firstly, I should have never put French in my book. But when you understand that there was a French physician who named it membre en tout, I believe is how you say that. For all my French people, just let me know how bad it is in the comments. I giggle every time when people are like butchered and I'm like, true. Anyhow, but it means shameful member. Okay, so that's what they named the clitoris. Now understand that the clitoris and the penis, same tissue. We were embryos and here came this wash of testosterone and it picked up on the fact that like there was this Y chromosome. The Y chromosome's like, I have the gene. And if you have the gene, now we're going to go away from the clitoris and we're going to go penis instead. And all of society is like, of course you have to stroke a penis for a man to orgasm. Like that just makes sense. Like, yes. But then they're like, but the clitoris, what does that have to do with anything? And I'm like, how can you understand science and not understand this? Like, I don't understand me. I am now lost. So with that, understand that not only was it named a shameful member, but pleasure was deemed shameful. And this organ only exists for pleasure. And medicine actually removed it. They were like, we know about it, but we're not going to share about it. We're not even going to teach doctors about it. And so it wasn't until the late 90s that it was acknowledged. When the headlines were like, the clitoris was discovered. Now I was like a teen at the time and I wasn't even paying attention to like any news like that. But, you know, later in my research, when I came across that and I was like, what? It wasn't discovered then. It was acknowledged. It was actually acknowledged then. And that's the difference. And that is something I think it's been horrible for women, not just from a sexual piece, you know, of the conversation, but because there are surgeries being done and doctors are essentially blind. They don't understand clitoral anatomy. And it's so interesting when you look at like, even now you and I are talking in 2023 and there's doctors who deny that the cervix even has any nerve endings, yet we know that it does and we found it. And in a lot of ways, it's just what they were taught because it's more convenient when you place an IUD or you biopsy a cervix to say, oh, you're not going to feel it. You don't have any nerve endings. Except then they say like, oh, you're going to feel a pinch. how would I feel that? So, you know, there's this, I go through the book in detail. If people like the history, the shocking history, they can definitely get it in the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very shocking. But I want to talk as well about the orgasm gap and some of the reasons for this gap. And I know that the history of how the clitoris has been hidden from medical papers and all this stuff for so long will be a reason for that gap, because I think so many women don't realize that they need clitoral stimulation to be able to orgasm. So yeah, can we talk about the orgasm gap and like what are some of the reasons behind that? Because there's women that can't orgasm with their partner, but then when they're on their own with a vibrator, they can do it in like a few minutes. So like that causes a lot of confusion for some women. So like what's going on there, and like how can they start to actually orgasm with their partner instead?
Yeah, I don't think women don't understand that they need clitoral stimulation. I think that male counterparts do not understand. So the orgasm gap only exists between heterosexual couples. So men, they're orgasming at a frequency about 95% of the time, every time they do the deed, whereas women, it's more like 65%. So it's a huge discrepancy. And then there comes the people that are like, well, you know, it's so hard to make a woman orgasm. But as you just said, women can do it in a matter of minutes if they do it themselves. And then they're like, oh, it's just because she's using a toy. Not everybody uses a toy, bro. And in same-sex lesbian couples, they orgasm, their orgasm frequency is like in the 80s, like 86%. It's like, it's up there. And so no. This is a penis problem. And it's not that your penis is a problem. It's that sex ed taught all of us that sex is a penis and vagina. Foreplay is even the word that we use to say, like, this is just getting ready for you to have a penis in your vagina. Where foreplay is sex in itself. You might orgasm with foreplay and be very, very satisfied. Job well done. But then society's like, that's not enough. You have to have put a penis in vagina. And it's not like people are out there just like outright saying it. There's subtle messages happening throughout media. There is what is taught in sex ed. I mean, we're taught in sex ed, the vagina exists solely for a penis to come in and a baby to come out. And it's like, well, what about us? Like, what about us? Like, we own this vagina. So the orgasm gap can be solved in part through the understanding of the clitoris, becoming clitorate. You can't see my necklace behind my mic, but that's my clitorate necklace that I wear and strike up conversations everywhere about this. So becoming clitorate, as Ian Kerner, he first coined the term, as I give him credit in the book. So understanding the clitoris, and also understanding that if she has an orgasm first, she is more likely to have an orgasm with penetration. So if that's the goal, if penetration's the goal, that is one way to improve the orgasm rate. And then also to understand that if you are having penetrative sex, there is going to have to be clitoral stimulation for the majority of women. Roughly 18% of women can orgasm vaginally. And even with that, it's like, well, there probably is clitoral stimulation still happening, because the clitoris is not just the nub that we see that sticks out of the body, but it is a wishbone that goes around the vaginal canal. And so there's still stimulation happening there. But the most sensitive part is the part that's under the hood. So if you look under the hood and you stimulate there, that is where most women are going to orgasm from. So you can use toys in the bedroom as well. So there can be manual stimulation. You can try different positions. You can stimulate it yourself, or you can bring in toys. And this is where there's so many myths. Men need to just stop acting like they know women's bodies better than them. That's like the big... we might have just arrived at the moment of like, that's actually the problem, is that men are teaching men about women's bodies, and men are the ones being like, well, this is the way, and you know, the only way. And then they have these myths of like, if you're using toys, that like that toy's competing with them, or the toy is going to desensitize your clitoris, so you made your clitoris not work for their penis. And like, it's a lot of blame and shame on the woman. And don't have sex with somebody like that. Just don't. Just like, they're toss them. Well, we're like talking to someone in the UK. Rubbish, friends. Rubbish is what I would say. Just let them go. But, you know, the toy situation, I always tell men, this is like, like put it on your utility belt like you're Batman, okay? This is your sidekick in the bedroom. They're very fun. There's lots of them out there. You can go exploring at a sex shop together. If you're like, no, we don't do that, you can order online. It'll be very, very discreet. And you can bring in toys and different things to experiment with in the bedroom. And no, a toy is not going to destroy or change a clitoris so that it can never be, you know, stimulated by their partner in any way to achieve pleasure. And that's just a really big myth. You can have a session where you go too hard or too long. That definitely can happen, especially for women who are on SSRIs or maybe their estrogen is high and so serotonin is up. That can make it where it's harder to achieve an orgasm or just different times in your cycle as well, as I explain in the book. But what the research has shown us is that even if you're like, oh, things are a little numb, a little sore afterwards, it's like riding a bike. I don't know if you guys have ever taken a spin class or riding a horse. Like, you didn't damage it forever, okay? It's going to come back. It's not even damaged. It's just like it has had a little bit of trauma, right? But like in this case, I would take that trauma to, you know, my vulva over the spin class any day.
Yeah, exactly. So for people maybe listening now, maybe they are thinking, well, now I've got more information, okay, I'm with my partner and I want to have more orgasms. What is your advice for approaching that conversation? Because I think that's where it gets really messy with how do people approach conversation if they're scared of maybe offending, scared of the ego getting involved. I don't know, do you have like some kind of tips or some kind of like crash course of like how people can introduce these conversations?
Totally. So in the 28-day program, I take you through how to heal your hormones, how to work through your like each phase of your menstrual cycle to optimize where your estrogen, progesterone, and testosterone are, but also your cortisol, your insulin, your thyroid, all of these play a big role in your sexual health. Now, part of that program is I also take you through different journaling exercises and sexual exercises, should you choose that. If you're like, I just want the hormones, don't worry, you can just do that. And if you're like, I want it all, then I got you. And so I take you through this. And one of the times where orgasms can be a lot easier to achieve and multiples can be easier to achieve is around ovulation. And that's because with both estrogen and testosterone, the clitoris can become more sensitive. So your brain is going to have these hormones stimulating it to fantasize about sex, to be easier to get aroused. You'll self-lubricate a lot more easily. And so that's the phase in your cycle where experimentation can just be wonderful. In terms of, so knowing that, knowing about your body, you can time things to be more successful and then have a conversation with your partner from the perspective of, this is what I like. I like it when you do this. I would like to try this with you. So it's always from a place of what you like. It's in a positive framework and it is about how you're being inclusive with them, rather than the, I don't like this, don't do this. And this is same is true when you're having sex. A lot of people feel like it's so awkward to have conversations during sex. And I'm like, it's so weird. Okay, I've been one of those people as well in my like early 20s. And I'm like, it's so weird that we'll like let somebody in our body and we'll get naked with them. But we're like, I don't want to talk about it. And yet we do. And that is also a normal experience. But understand that when you look at the research, a very, very high percentage of people are turned on with dirty talk. So when you're giving directions and instructions, as you will have to do for your partner to understand your body and what works, do it in a positive, spicy kind of way. Don't overthink it. I mean, even just like moaning is positive feedback to them. So communication outside the bedroom, communication in the bedroom. Understand it is totally normal that when you are like really like you're feeling that tension build, because that's what an orgasm is. We build the tension, then we have the release. As you're getting up with the tension, they're gonna want to go faster. They're gonna be getting excited, and they might even do things where you're like, oh my god, ow. If it ever hurts, you all permission to be like, ow, stop, this hurts. Like you can totally shut it down, because pain with sex is not something you should just tolerate. But if they do start going down that route, instead of being like, oh, no, not like that, saying like, oh, can you go back to what you were doing before? I really enjoyed that. Or like, oh, that was so hot. Like, you know, when you were going slow and like, oh, I you know, or like, give it to me slow, like this kind of language, that can really help your partner stay in the moment, help you stay in the moment. And it's giving feedback in a way that gets you what you want, gets your partner what they want, and helps you enhance that communication in the relationship in the bedroom.
Yeah, that's really good tips. I feel like sometimes thinking about, oh, I need to start communicating about sex. How do I do that? You think you need to have some like big conversation, but obviously even just like you said, moaning, stuff like that, that's communication. You don't need to overthink that or like have a, you know, so yeah, that's really, really good tips.
Well, even body language. I was just going to say, even body language. If you're like, I don't want to make any sounds because maybe you have kids around and somebody, the threat of somebody walking in on you or seeing you or hearing you is a break for some people. So I should say body language is enough. You can put your hand on their hand. You can move your body in a certain way. So body language is also communication. Just for my people who are like, that resonate with the Netflix and chill story in my book. If you resonate with that, then like body language is enough.
Yeah. I'd love to know as well, what are some of the things, obviously your whole book is all about everything's being normal, but like what are some of the things that are completely normal that are really not seen as normal in sex and women's health? Like the main things that you think people should know about?
Gosh, well, we've covered so much. Fantasies. So I go through fantasies. I go through different interests. I even talk about kink and how it's kind of funny that we call it kink as if it's something so different because a lot of people participate in kink, like a lot of people, because spanking is considered kink. And so just for people to understand, fetishes are normal, being turned on by different, you know, different acts in the bedroom that you've never heard about, you've never seen about. Like you just are like, I don't even know where this arrived in my brain, but I'm really into it. It's also normal. There is a lot that happens in people's bedrooms that we're not talking about. But, you know, the only exposure that we really get to sex is through mainstream media in a lot of cases. Some people do watch pornography, but then you like have to know what to search in some of these instances as well. But just for people to know that if different things turn you on, so, you know, I think, you know, a common one that people are like, that don't have this fetish are like, is like feet and, you know, people sucking on your toes, playing with your feet, even massages, you know, being like a, like massaging your feet, being a really big turn on. I had a patient who said she could orgasm when her partner was massaging her feet. And she's like, that's weird. Right. And I was like, that's awesome. Okay. That's like really awesome. And also like, but what's an orgasm, right? It's like the clitoris is the main way to orgasm, but an orgasm is happening in the brain. It is happening with your hormones. So I want people to know that that's all normal. If you are into period sex, that's also normal. I get asked about that all the time. I talk about it in the book. I talk about the benefits of it. And, you know, I talk about the benefits of orgasms and pleasure throughout every part of your cycle, but definitely, you know, around your periods, it can release endorphins that help with mitigating pain, which, I mean, who doesn't want that?
Yeah. So like, do you, some people I think feel like they get a bit more horny as well on their period. Like what are the hormones going on there? Like with, cause obviously like society's like, ooh, period sex. You don't want to like do that when you're bleeding, da da, but sometimes your desire goes up during that time. So like what's going on there?
Yeah. Okay. So, and just pro tip, if you're like, I don't want the mess, do it in the shower. If you don't want the mess, do it in the shower. So I love that you asked this. So let's talk a little bit about the menstrual cycle. And I have graphs and I go through all of this in the book. And then I take you through each phase of the menstrual cycle for you to understand not only your sexual health, but what's going on with your mood, what's going on with everything in your life and how to better support your body. So when we're on our period, our hormones have dropped. So prior to that, that's when progesterone was up. So to get to the period, We drop our hormones. And when I told you before, progesterone, that's going to make you want to cuddle, like literal Netflix and chill, not innuendo, no innuendo there. That is what's going on in the luteal phase. And if your progesterone's not right, you may be having a lot of PMS. And when you don't have enough progesterone, your estrogen's up. There's been small studies, and we need more to really understand this further and validate it. But I think even without having like robust literature, a lot of women can resonate with the idea that when your estrogen is left unchallenged by progesterone and you're in that PMS and you're feeling irritable, you can be a lot more critical of your partner. So that can be another thing. That's why I'm like, let's get in here and let's work on this progesterone and estrogen, and I show you how to optimize those and get them, you know, in a balanced state with one another. Understand they are fluctuating throughout your cycle, but there should be a balance of your hormones happening. Now, when you go through, so you're in that late PMS, so you might not be into your partner, now you're feeling bloated, cranky, all of those things. Your progesterone drops, and here's why it drops. Your luteinizing hormone, LH from the brain, is telling the corpus luteum, a structure that's left behind in the ovaries, to continue to produce progesterone. It can only do that for so long. It depends on beta HCG, pee on a stick, you're pregnant, that hormone, it depends on that being present. And then that beta HCG helps that LH pulse continue so you keep your progesterone around. When there is no implantation, therefore you are not pregnant, there is no beta HCG, that LH signal fails. Now the progesterone drops. Progesterone drops, make way for testosterone unchallenged. And even while you're bleeding, this is where people are like, the period is like this different phase, and it's like for your uterus, but not for your ovaries, friends, because your ovaries are like, you may be bleeding, but baby, we're going to be getting down soon because we're getting ready to ovulate. And so even by day two of your period, your estrogen is coming up. And a lot of people think about, oh, testosterone is why we're into sex. Testosterone is why we orgasm. Yes, and estrogen is a really key player. So with progesterone removed and one of the key breaks that, you know, gets triggered for a lot of people. So back to that gas pedal trip brake analogy is, we know that day one, two, three of our period, we ain't getting pregnant. There's very, very low risk of pregnancy. And so with that fear removed from our mind, that can also help us get aroused. So we've got the hormonal component, and then we've got the psychological component of what's going on. Does that all make sense?
Yeah, no, it's so fascinating. We've obviously spoke loads about like the hormonal changes and how that changes your desire and sex drive and all those kind of things. But as well, if you've got any like tips on like a simple breakdown of like the phases of our menstrual cycle for any of our listeners that don't already know. And then like, because basically I really notice at certain points in my cycle, I'm way less confident. I don't want to socialize as much. So me going to a party with loads of people I don't know is like really not ideal. And then at other points, like I'm super motivated for the gym. I can lift really heavy weights. And then other times I literally don't want to be there and I can't lift anything. And I just, you know, like, and then other times, you know, you're feeling super confident and chatty and you want to be out. There's all these different like parts of your cycle where you can't focus at work and stuff like that. And I feel like the more you know about it, the easier it is to have more compassion for yourself and be able to kind of plan your calendar around knowing this and like just make your life a bit easier. So could you give like a little mini like crash course on that for like our listeners that maybe don't know anything about that?
Sure. So here's what's to understand. Okay, we break the cycle down into four phases. There's really only three because the follicular phase is the whole first part because it's all about the ovaries trying to get the follicle mature, get to ovulation. But we do say the period is different and succinct because you do feel different. So just know that like, in medicine, your doctor will always be like, there's follicular ovulation, then there is luteal phase, and there's none of this like other, you know, period phase. But if you have a period, then you know, like, you know what I'm saying. So really your cycle starts with ovulation, but we always teach it from menstruation because that is obvious, is very obvious when you're bleeding. So starting with the period, like I said already, progesterone goes down, estrogen has come up. Estrogen is really great with memory, with being strategic, with planning. So your brain is going to get stimulated. And as your testosterone is up and going to continue creeping up a bit, testosterone is present in the entire cycle, but it does get a little bit higher before ovulation. You're going to start feeling like, I can set boundaries. So maybe the first few days of your period, you're like, I'm kind of crying. And, you know, and that's really really uncommon for the period, but it could happen. Usually that crying's happening in the PMS, premenstrual phase. And so with that, testosterone helps with the boundaries. And as testosterone and estrogen continue to rise in your cycle and you're moving out of your period, now you're finding that you can lift heavy. You are finding that you could get less sleep, but please don't do that. It's not good for you, but you can if you have to. You can push a lot harder and you feel a lot more like resilient. And that's because these estrogen and testosterone levels are starting to peak. Now, within the ovulatory window, so about 3 days before you ovulate, estrogen really ramps up. That is when your libido is going to go up. And there's some research that calls this the sexual phase. So it's not just about ovulation. It's also the time that you feel very sexually primed. Like I said, you're going to fantasize about sex more. And with that estrogen really coming up and that testosterone coming up, that can feel like the time where you do have the most energy. You're also going to notice that you have plumper lips, plumper hips, butt thighs, less fine lines and wrinkles, your breasts are more plump, you feel more sexual, like you really feel yourself. This is where in the book I'm like, this is the time to do the exercise of getting in the mirror and loving yourself and writing it down, because once you move out of that ovulatory phase, now we've got roughly like a 10, maybe 14 day window of the luteal phase. And that is where estrogen now takes a backseat to progesterone. Initially in that phase, you will feel a lot more connected to community, a lot more communicative. You will be chatty sometimes, but as you move through that phase and get to that like last week before your period, social anxiety can definitely crop up more. Sensory processing issues if you have those. So if your neighbors are banging on the wall repetitively, you might be feeling like you're losing your mind kind of situation. So you can feel a lot more irritable. And that, like, I will say that there's a spectrum of normal, but it's on the side of you are functional and it's not hijacking your life. If you're not functional and it's hijacking your life, please grab "Is This Normal?" because I will help you repair all of that and get things back on track. So that's roughly, there's so much more I could say. That was like my, like, let's sprint through this.
Yeah.
No, exactly. I think like anyone listening probably will want to rewind this and like take notes or buy your book, because like just that knowledge helps you understand yourself so much better. And it's just something that in school and all that, we're just never taught anything about. It's like, we're just taught, we're on like 24-hour clock, but it's so different for women. So we're coming to the end now, but one thing that is obviously a huge part of your work is hormone and hormone imbalances. So I did really like how you explained that like things can be really common, but just because they're common doesn't mean they're normal and you have to put up with it. So what are some signs that you may have a hormone imbalance that women shouldn't really like have to put up with?
Yeah. Okay. So we've covered a lot of it already, right? So having those PMS symptoms, feeling moody, feeling anxious, having trouble sleeping before your period, feeling really weepy or really irritable. Having anxiety can be a sign of hormone issues. So that should always be investigated. Same with depression. And doctors are really quick to jump to medication and glaze right over that you have a thyroid. And it could be thyroid disease as one example. When it comes to issues like acne, hair loss, even digestive upset or fatigue, we're sometimes told like, oh yeah, everybody's a little bit bloated. Like there was something on TikTok where it was like, all the hot girls bloat. And I'm like, no, they don't, friend. Can we investigate that? Because that could be hormone related. And then same with like, you'll sometimes see doctors say like, well, everyone's fatigued these days. Everyone's fatigued. So I don't even worry about it. And I'm like, well, fatigue could be cancer. So I would really hope that you would worry about it. That's kind of scary. But fatigue can also be low testosterone. It can be thyroid disease. It can be adrenal dysfunction. It can be insulin dysregulation. And so these are, all, I don't say all of this to like scare people, but these are things that you should definitely evaluate. And I think it's important for people to know that there are tests that we absolutely need to do. Like for thyroid, we absolutely need to do blood work. And then there's other things where it's like, well, your doctor may not order progesterone or estrogen unless you want to have a baby. And then they might not even order testosterone unless they suspect PCOS. And so that's why I gave in the book a questionnaire. It's the same questionnaire that I use with patients to evaluate their hormones that guides my testing and what I suspect's going on. And then what I give you for the answers is nutrition, lifestyle and supplementation, things that you can begin, you can incorporate, you can support yourself with, that even if you did need support from a doctor, you would do these things anyway. So it really just gives you a leg up. I tell you when you need to see a doctor, by the way, but it gives you a leg up so that even if you do need the doctor, whatever the intervention they have, this is only going to enhance it and make it work better. But it's very much my experience and my clinical, opinion that the majority of healing happens outside of the doctor's office. And the things that keep you outside the doctor's office is what you do in your day to day. So that's what I aim to provide. And is this normal? I'm like, let me just give it to you so that you could do it. And if you never need us, then I'm like, I'm gonna call it a win.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. So yeah, everyone needs to go and grab a copy of your book, Is This Normal? Because it is incredible and there's so many amazing tips, as well as obviously everything that you've given today. So we just wanted to ask you the one final question, like, what is one thing that you wish all women knew?
You are the only one who knows what your normal is. You live in your body, you know your experience, and never let anyone gaslight you, dismiss you, or tell you that they are the expert of your own body.
Amazing. Love it.
Wow, it's been such an incredible interview. It's been so much incredible advice. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. I really appreciated these questions and the ability to just talk candidly and freely about all these topics.
Yeah, it's been incredible. So where can everybody find you if they don't already follow you on social media? And obviously you've got your latest book out, which everyone can get wherever they get their books.
You can find me at drbrighton.com, drbrighton.com. That is my main hub. And then I'm all over social media, Dr. Jolene Brighton. And my name's a little tricky. The last name is Brighten. So Brighton like the sun, not Brighton like the UK.
That was such a good episode. Really, really hope you took away loads of value from it. I'm sure you will have. And definitely go follow Jolene and definitely buy her books. They're really amazing. Is This Normal is her new book. And then there's also Beyond the Pill if you are interested in contraception. And it's not even about just that. It's about like loads of things to do with contraception, not just the pill. That's what I meant. Sorry. So go and buy those two books. And yeah, whenever you feel like you have some kind of question, pop on her Instagram if it's to do with this field and you'll get the answer.
Oh yeah, so informative. I love her new book, Is This Normal? Like, I feel like I flick through it when I've got questions. Like the other week I had really bad PMS and I was like, is this normal? You know, have I got too much PMS? What's going on here? And like went and was like reading up about it and I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah, it's like a little...
It's like a Bible.
Yeah.
Female knowledge that you need to know. So go and get yourself a copy. It's really informative and very... It's easy to read. It's not like... You know, it's all about like all these things that we probably don't know that much about. It's not like overwhelming. Like you can take in. I just go and read little bits when I'm curious. It's very good. Very good book. So yeah, go and grab yourselves a copy of that and give her a follow. And if you like this episode, let us know. Leave us a star rating on Spotify, Apple Podcasts. Leave us a review. Love hearing your feedback. Come and chat to us on Instagram at Find Your Feet Podcast. Let us know what's your favorite part of this episode. What did you take away? What did you learn? Let Dr. Jolene know as well. Tag her, tag us in your story reshares. We love it when you guys do that. Really helps us get the pod out to more people as well. Help more women out there with their hormonal health and their sexual health and their orgasms. You know, we're passionate about that.
We are.
But thanks for listening and we'll see you next Wednesday.